Welcome. You have checked into the enigmatic Riverside Hotel. My name is Carl, and as your concierge, I will guide you through our evening entertainment. Hello, and welcome to the pilot episode of the Enigmatic Riverside Hotel Show. As you heard that intro say, I'm Carl. I will be your concierge. I'm a volunteer here at CJSF, and if my voice sounds familiar, I have done two other shows on the station. One of those is Jambalaya, which is a music show that I still do on Wednesdays at 3 p.m. And then Speak Up, which is kind of a talk show format that I used to do on Mondays at 10 a.m. But the point of this new show is basically I want to tell stories in any way, shape, or form. Those can be history, which is the case for most of the stories in this episode. They can be educational, they can even be interviews. But basically I want to tell stories that teach you something, that you can gain something from, or at best that can entertain you in any way. And there will be something different every week. So it'll be an ever-changing format, basically. And all this will take place in the Enigmatic Riverside Hotel, which is the setting for this whole thing. So for the first part of our show, please follow me down to our archives, and let's take a look back at some history. So starting things off today, on February 25, 138 CE, Roman Emperor Hadrian realizes that without a son, he has no successor and adopts the 51-year-old Antoninus. Could be Antoninus. I found multiple pronunciations of that name online. Antoninus became known as one of the five good emperors. His reign was peaceful and he was well-liked by both the common people and those in the Roman government. Ironically, he was far from the first choice. Hadrian actually wanted Marcus Aurelius to succeed him, but he was only 16 at the time. His second choice was Lucius Sionius Commodus, but he had died of tuberculosis 2 years after his adoption. So the deal was made that Antoninus would adopt Marcus Aurelius so that he could succeed him when he was older. However, Hadrian probably didn't expect that Antoninus would live 23 more years, having the second longest reign of any Roman emperor. In more history, on February 25, 1923, bread in Berlin rises to 2,000 marks, which was the German currency before the euro at the time. Inflation was a big problem in Germany in these times. Basically, after World War I, Germany was supposed to pay reparations to the winners of World War I, but Germany didn't want to lend money from any other countries, which ended up being a very financially irresponsible choice because it led to them having to print more money, which then decreased the value of the mark. And for an example of how this inflation affected a product, the price of a daily newspaper rose from 0.3 marks in January 1921 to 1 mark in May 1922, to 8 marks in October 1922, to 100 marks in February 1923, and to 1,000 marks in September of 1923. In the fall of 1923, prices completely took off, and by the 17th of November 1923, in less than 2 months, the price of the daily newspaper was by 70 million marks. So just imagine having to, like, all the physical money you'd have to gather up to just simply get a newspaper, which is so ridiculous. In some more depressing German history, on February 25, 1933, Austrian immigrant Adolf Hitler gets German citizenship in Braunschweig, Germany, which, fun fact, is my hometown and the only time in history that we ever come up, which is probably not all too flattering. And another fun fact, New Brunswick in Canada is named after Braunschweig. Brunswick is kind of like the pre-modernized version of our name, and there's like hundreds of Brunswicks all over Canada and the US, but we're the original. Yeah, my Braunschweig, it has its nasty parts, but it's a nice city overall with some cool historic buildings and a somewhat functional public transport system. Shout out to the 411, the bus that I had to take twice daily for over 12 years. But moving on, and more actual history. On this day in 1963, the Beatles released their first single in the US, Please Please Me, which will actually be our next act here in the hotel event room, because who would have thought we actually got the Beatles to reunite after one of them is already dead and come here. In more Beatles, on February 25, 1969, the recording for Abbey Road began. Abbey Road is by some referred to as their best album, and it's arguably their most iconic one. But surprisingly, critical reception of Abbey Road was initially pretty mixed. Ed Ward of the Rolling Stone called the album complicated instead of complex. And Nick Cohn of the New York Times said that individually, the album's songs are nothing special. Abbey Road is also really well known for really fueling fire to the Paul is dead rumor. The idea behind that was that the Beatles on the album cover are actually coming from the cemetery after Paul McCartney's funeral. His procession was led by Lennon, who is dressed in white as a religious figure. Ringo is dressed in black as the Undertaker. McCartney is a barefoot corpse, and Harrison, dressed in denim, is the gravedigger. The left-handed McCartney is holding a cigarette in his right hand, indicating that he is an imposter, because the real Paul McCartney was obviously left-handed, and the number plate on the Volkswagen that's in the background says 28 if, meaning that Paul McCartney would have been 28 if he had lived. The thing about this whole thing is that Paul McCartney was actually 27 when Abbey Road came out, and also when this picture was taken. So really, it's just a, like, really unfounded theory. But yeah, as I said earlier, our next musical act here, Please Please Me by the Beatles. During our music break just then, one of our guests was asking me how to get around here in Vancouver. Well, it kind of depends on where you want to go, but one of the ways is by taking the SkyTrain. And before you do that, have a listen to some of our guests' opinions on SkyTrains.
Out of all the SkyTrain lines, which one is your favorite?
Favorite, that's a tough one. Mm-hmm. I definitely ride the Canada line the most, and given that it is sort of newest and freshest, I like it, but it makes me mad because it's very seriously under-engineered and is already at capacity 10 years after being opened with no possibility of expanding its capacity. So that, like, really drives home that point to me every time I try to get on the train at 8:30 on a weekday and have to squeeze in like a sardine.
You know, personally, I'm very fond of the Expo line. Mm-hmm. Because for one, you have the, like, where it shows all the stations, it actually has lights.
Yeah, that's fun, for sure.
And then secondly, it has those seats that you can, like, at the end of every, like, wagon.
Yeah, the, like, the front seat, so you can, like, as if you're driving.
That one, and the one that you can, like, that's that kind of secret, you know,
that
you can.
Down.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I like that for sure. There's something about the like the classic 1980s SkyTrain that was just the Expo Line. Expo Line is the first one.
Yeah.
And that was originally just like down and around the loop.
I feel like since like 2000 was the Millennium Line, mm-hmm. and 2010 was the Canada Line, I feel like it's time for a new SkyTrain.
We did just get the Evergreen Line, which if you want to go up into the Tri-Cities, into Port Coquitlam, etc., that's a very nice... Yeah, it goes all the way right up to like Coquitlam Center Mall, and it's called like Brewery Alley or something. There's a whole bunch of breweries and stuff.
It already exists?
Yeah.
So there's a fourth SkyTrain that exists, and I didn't even know about this.
Yeah, it's just... It's kind of an extension of the Millennium Line. So some trains go down it and then turn south after Lougheed and then go down around the loop towards what's it called, the one where you switch trains to go to Surrey, Columbia,
yeah.
But then every other train breaks off north and then goes up along North Road up into Port Coquitlam. I have personally never ridden.
Yeah,
but
I need to try this.
Apparently, it's like a big thing to take the train out there, go to a bunch of breweries, and then
On what the best SkyTrain line is feels invalid now that I haven't even tried all of them.
Yeah, you don't have the full experience.
Oh, damn. You're stranded on a desert island. Which SkyTrain line do you take with you?
I take the Canada line to the airport.
Oh, that's smart. That's very smart. I like that. I like the logical thinking behind that. Jacob, what is your favorite SkyTrain line?
If I had to pick one of the three, I would probably pick the Millennium line, because when I was growing up and getting involved with the music community or just straight up going downtown, the Millennium line got me there. And I knew exactly how long it would take for me to get there, because my mom's house, where I was living until I was 23, I knew exactly, it would take an hour, exactly, almost, to get from Port Moody to the Granville Station downtown. And then from there, the world's my oyster.
Would you say you feel a very intimate connection to the Millennium Line?
Oh, Lord, no. I only take it if I have to now.
So what I'm going to get to next is the history of the SkyTrain, and then each individual SkyTrain line. Now, personally, I love the SkyTrain. I think it's way comfier than any other subway or train line I've been in. It's also less smelly, it's cleaner, and also the fact that it's over the earth and you get nice views all the time is what I like so much about the SkyTrain. Now, about Vancouver SkyTrain system. Vancouver SkyTrain is the oldest and one of the longest fully automated driverless rapid transit systems in the world. Famously, the original SkyTrain was presented at the Expo 86 in 1986. Its predecessor was the British Columbia Electric Railway, which used streetcars. And one of those is actually showcased at the Old Spaghetti Factory in Gastown. So you can actually have your meal in one of these old streetcars. However, in the late 1950s, streetcar ridership was in decline due to the increasing number of buses and private cars, and the system was shut down. Without any rail network, traffic problems got worse in the 60s and 70s, and the people of Vancouver also opted against a freeway system, which made things even worse. So in 1980, the planners behind the project decided for an advanced light rail transit system that was to be shown off at the World Fair in 86. The fair had a transportation theme and was to be called the Transpo 86, which later just became the Expo 86. Ideas for a new public transport system had been discussed throughout the entirety of the 60s and 70s, but the international attention that the Expo would receive was just the push that the city needed, and the SkyTrain was to be the Expo's centerpiece. The advanced light rail transit system also had the advantage of being Canadian-owned, which means that lots of profits could be made from non-Canadian cities buying the system. And also, since the SkyTrain would be driverless, this would mean fewer unionized public sector workers, so strikes would basically be less effective. And yes, all of this is very ironic, considering last year's threatened public transport strikes. But this is where you get to the Expo Line, which is my personal favorite because it has the best seats and the best views. As a lot of you who were around will know, this line was originally just the SkyTrain. But to make differentiation simpler, I'll stick to calling this one the Expo Line. So construction of the Expo Line began on March 1, 1982, and was initially just intended as a demonstration project of the technology. At the time, Main Street was the only station that would later become Main Street Science World. I actually found a video by BC Transit about this very demonstration, which even in audio form can give you a good idea about the hype around the SkyTrain.
November 1982. The physical shape of rapid transit to come begins to emerge along the demonstration section on Terminal Avenue. Hundreds are employed both on and off-site as the world's most advanced transit technology accelerates into being. Men and machines begin to refashion an abandoned gravel pit not far from New Westminster. Maintenance yards and the control center will be built here.
Any command that is given.
February 5th, 1983. British Columbia's Premier Bill Bennett visits and experiences the new technology where it was developed in Kingston, Ontario. Accompanied by the press and by families of the people working at Ontario's Urban Transportation Development Corporation, Premier Bennett discovers a surprising feature of the system. Even at 80 kilometers an hour, it runs so quietly, normal conversation is possible. More like riding an elevator than a train, remarked one commentator. Car bodies for the BC system will be built here, not far from the Kingston test track. 2, 4, even 6 cars will make up each train. They will run 2 to 5 minutes apart, depending on the time of day, the weight of passenger traffic. Each car is powered by 2 linear induction motors, reacting and running against a fixed rail between the tracks. The first such system in the world. 4 axles per car steer around curves on continuous welded rails to avoid the clatter and screech trains usually make. The system will be totally automated, with supervisory staff manning the control center. Roving information and security attendants in trains and stations to serve passengers. There will be TV monitors in stations, electronic obstacle detection along the tracks, and an extensive state-of-the-art communications network. A tried and tested control system improves on the already exceptionally high safety standards rapid transit riders experience everywhere.
I really like the whole 80s vibe of this whole news report. So the Expo Line began service on December 11, 1985, with free service on the weekends, which was nice, probably. I was pretty far away from being around. And during the Expo 86 in the next year, a third track was built to go from stadium to waterfront station, just for the attendance of the Expo. Originally, the trains had actual fancy carpeting, which had to be replaced in 1992 because they were too hard to maintain, obviously, which is how the SkyTrain got those signature wax floors that all of the lines still have today. The original Expo Line ran from Waterfront to New Westminster, with plans for a station on Boundary and Kingsway. This station was meant to serve employees of BC Tel, however those plans were scrapped, with the reason being that they didn't want to attract more crime to the neighborhood. The first extension of the line happened in 1989, when Columbia Station opened, and in 1990 with Scott Road in Surrey. Shortly after, the Gateway and Surrey Central stations were added. And then a big year for the Expo Line was 2002, when the Millennium Line was opened, because this is where it was branded from just the SkyTrain to the Expo Line. And in 2016, the most recent change happened to the Expo Line, that being the opening of a new branch that goes from Columbia to Production Way, which is the one that I always take, and the same for most of you at SFU probably. I mean, at the Enigmatic Riverside Hotel. What am I saying? This is where we are, the Enigmatic Riverside Hotel. And then there's the Millennium Line, which opened in 2002, named after, you guessed it, the Millennium. In the following years, it was extended to Lake City Way and VCC Clark. In 2016, it was expanded with the Evergreen Line, which is kind of false advertising since it's not much of a new line at all. It's just the Millennium Line with added stations. The name Evergreen Line was selected in late 2005 as the result of a six-week-long naming contest because the project was originally not a SkyTrain project and required a separate name to identify with a different type of service. In the contest, 1,450 entries were submitted, and it came down to Spirit Line and Evergreen Line, out of which focus groups preferred Evergreen Line. Now, I love the name Spirit Line, but it definitely sounds more like a 70s soft rock band than a SkyTrain line. The winner of the contest was a woman named Marion Harmer from Port Coquitlam, and she received the prize option of either $500 towards the purchase of a bicycle or 6 months of transit passes. What she chose, we might never know, because this article doesn't mention it, sadly. She was also given the opportunity to be the first member of the public to ride the new line when it would eventually open. In 2009, the youngest of the SkyTrain lines, the Canada Line, was opened, or as it was originally called, the RAV Line, which stands for Richmond Airport Vancouver. It goes from Waterfront Station down to either YVR Airport or Richmond Brickhouse. The need for a train that connects the rest of the city to the airport seems pretty obvious, and it's also a big win for those folks in Richmond and South Van to get downtown much faster and without having to take 5 different buses. Trust me, I'm speaking from experience here. However, when it was built, it was not without controversy. A lot of people claimed the Canada Line would only really pay off during the 2010 Olympics, and after that, no one else would use it, which I think anyone who's ever tried to get a seat on the Canada Line during rush hour can definitely dispute. Interestingly enough, provisions have been made for several new stations to be added, including one on Canby and 33rd Avenue, which would be right at Queen Elizabeth Park, and one on 57th Avenue. There are no serious plans for any of these to be built in the near future, though. So yeah, that about concludes the history of the current SkyTrain lines. Of course, people are always talking about a potential UBC line, which has been in planning since, like, literally forever. Right now, the closest thing to that is the Broadway Subway project, which is supposed to extend the Millennium Line to Broadway and Arbutus. Personally, I think it's very ironic that we here at SFU are literally on top of a mountain, and not even in Vancouver, but we have better SkyTrain connectivity than UBC. Next up, to tie into the whole SkyTrain theme of this episode, our next act here will be Emotions with AZ with the song SkyTrain.
The East Van mixtape. Emotions, DJ Moves.
The next station
yeah.
is
from the glamorous to gritty. If you're living in the city, then I know that you've heard.
The next station is
from King George to Waterfront, smoking on a lot of blunts. Don't forget what
the next station is.
Just riding on the SkyTrain, trying to save some time, man. Everybody say
the next station is.
This is a song about the place we from, and that bitch on the intercom.
The next station is
right. This for my people on the block. Even if you in the bands, I remember you were riding on the. Some people getting stabbed or shot, buying bags of rock up on the. In high school, we used to tag a lot. Fuck them transit cops up on the. I used to take the train to see the rooftops. My boy Plus rocked up on the. I get on at Broadway Station, dog, staying fresh a lot. Heading to the F and shop on the. Hit too many shots, fall asleep and wake up in some fucked up spots upon the. You're fuck paying for tickets. We deacon the mark ass guards just to holler at bitches upon the. This the East Van mixtape. Think about me next time on the train when the bitch say.
The next station is.
From the glamorous to gritty. If you're living in my city, then I know that you've heard.
The next station is.
From King George to Waterfront, smoking on a lot of blunts. Don't forget what
the next station is.
Just riding on the. the SkyTrain, trying to save some time, man. Everybody say,
the next station is,
this the song about the place we from, and that bitch on the intercom.
The next station is,
you're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM. I'm your host, Carl, and this show is Good Times at the Enigmatic Riverside Hotel. Our last act was Emotions with SkyTrain, and next up, we're going to have Diane and the Gentlemen with the Little Things EP, and after that, we will get to a segment of my yet untitled mystery show about broadcast hijackings. So when a TV or radio station gets hijacked by someone and they take over the broadcast. So stay tuned for that. Next up will be Diane and the Gentlemen.
Yeah.
take off your makeup, break up.
In this next, so far untitled segment, it's going to be some kind of mystery segment or something, but I just have no name yet. I'd like to talk about broadcast hijackings. So basically, when someone manages to hijack a radio or TV broadcast and broadcast themselves or recordings that they made. I've always found this sort of stuff super fascinating, how people come up with these super elaborate plans with self-built contraptions to take over a broadcast. And then also what these people's motivations are and what they hope to achieve by doing this. To learn about those, I did some research on some of the most famous cases of this kind of thing, and I'd like to present those to you. I'm not gonna get into too much detail on how these people did it, because I don't want any of you to take over my show, so don't get any ideas. But just so you know, it's not that easy to do anymore these days. Most of these cases happened in the last century, so please don't hijack my show. For this first case, and this is also one of the funniest cases of this in my opinion, is the religious takeover of the Playboy Channel in 1987. I don't think I need to elaborate on the kind of programming shown on the Playboy Channel and why certain religious folks might disagree with it, but on the night of September 6, 1987, the movie Three Daughters, which was running at the time, was suddenly interrupted by a black screen with white text saying, "Thus saith the Lord thy God, remember the Sabbath and keep it holy. Repent, for the kingdom of heaven is at hand." If you didn't know, Sabbath in Judaism and for some Christians is the day that God rested after creating the earth, so for those people it's the day of resting. Usually for most Jewish people that's Saturday, but for some people like our hijacker here it's Sunday, because this happened on a Sunday. When this was investigated, the jamming signal left behind very subtle clues that led the investigators to a particular brand of transmitter, which led them to the CBN, the Christian Broadcasting Network, as the culprit, which, I mean, seems like a very likely candidate considering the message at hand. a man named Thomas Haney of Virginia Beach, who was an uplink engineer on duty at the CBN at the time of the broadcast intrusion, was convicted of satellite piracy. Haney claimed to be innocent, and interestingly enough, neither the prosecution nor the defense were able to recreate this whole thing, but he was still convicted and received 3 years of probation, a $1,000 fine, and 150 hours of community service. And honestly, I'm not even trying to set up a mystery here or anything. All the evidence clearly speaks against Haney in this case. Much more mysterious, though, is the second case. And this is a very famous and even more obscure case of this, which was the Max Headroom incident, which also happened in 1987. In fact, a large majority of these cases are from the late 80s, which I guess is either down to the fact that equipment for this became more accessible to the public and broadcasters weren't prepared yet, or maybe it was just the fact that it was the late 80s. Either way, in the Max Headroom incident, a strange message was played on two TV stations in Chicago. On the evening of November 22, 1987, during a sports news segment on WGN-TV, the screen suddenly went black, and afterward 20 seconds of nothing, a person wearing a Max Headroom mask appeared. Now, Max Headroom was a TV character in the 80s who was supposed to be like an AI or some kind of robot who was kind of a parody of a very boring news anchor. Basically, it was an actor in makeup to look like he was computer generated who would introduce music videos on his show. The hijacker in this case was filming himself wearing a Max Headroom mask and sunglasses. And in the first intrusion, it was just footage of this guy staring into the camera and sort of jumping up and down. It may not sound creepy, but having watched the clip myself, I can confirm it's kind of unsettling, and without a warning, it must have been even worse. Understandably, the station got a lot of confused phone calls by viewers afterwards. In this case, the engineers at WGN-TV were able to cut the hijack short by switching their broadcast frequency to another transmitter. However, 2 hours later, another Chicago station wasn't so lucky. A local PBS station named WTTW was airing an old Doctor Who episode when the Max Headroom impersonator appeared again, and this time he was quite talkative. So I'm gonna let you make your own impression of this whole thing, and don't worry, I don't think this one is as creepy.
That is stupid. You should talk often with the old ones of your tribe. That is the only way to learn.
I'll get you a hot drink, miss.
Oh, I've done some dry clothes.
It's kind of hard to make out what exactly he's saying, but he refers to Chuck Swirsky, who was a local sportscaster, as a freaking liberal. He recreates a Coca-Cola ad with the actual Max Headroom when he says catch the wave, and at the end he's getting spanked with a fly swatter. In other words, this was not someone with any particular agenda at all, but just someone pulling a prank. According to the FCC, the perpetrator would receive a maximum $100,000 fine, up to a year in prison or both. What makes this case so infamous, though, is that to this day, the person behind this has not been identified, because there's virtually no way to trace this person. As always with this kind of thing, the mystery behind the person under the mask has intrigued a lot of people over the last 4 decades, especially with the rise of the internet. 9 years ago, a computer programmer named Bowie J. Pogue made a Reddit post with the name "I Believe I Know Who Was Behind the Max Headroom Incident" that occurred on Chicago TV in 1987. Pogue was 13 at the time of the incident and involved with the local hacking scene. He claims to know someone who he only refers to with the letter J for the sake of protecting his identity, and he describes J as someone with a dirty sense of humor and suffering from severe autism. At the day of the hijacking, Pogue was with J and a few other people in this hacking community when someone told him to watch Channel 11 later tonight. Someone else told Pogue that Jay was, quote-unquote, planning to do something big. After he made his Reddit post, several newspapers picked up the story of Pogue's claims, and this got him in touch with Rick Klein, who is the curator of the Museum of Classic Chicago Television, and the two started an investigation together, and eventually met with several engineers and technicians from the affected TV station and others at the time. And with their help, they came to the conclusion that, quote-unquote, the things which needed to have been possessed by an outside amateur or amateurs, no matter how talented, did not exist in the wild in 1987, which would clear Jay as a suspect, as he was not a TV engineer or anything. Klein speculates it may have been a, quote-unquote, former employee of WGN-TV or someone who got turned down for a job there, perhaps an engineer or someone with the technical knowledge and equipment to allow them to pull this off. I feel like this makes the most sense, especially since that specific sportcaster is referred to. But who knows, maybe it's a coach for something and no one's been able to figure it out. Either way, the mystery of the Max Headroom case remains a cold case. And wow, I just made this sound way more mysterious than it probably is in real life. But anyway, case 3. If you thought the last one was weird, this one is... it may be weirder. It depends on your definition of weird, I guess. I'm not hyping this up very well, am I? Anyway, case 3. We have the case of the Southern Television Broadcast Interruption. And this happened 10 years earlier, on November 26, 1977, in the UK. During the early evening news on Southern Television, which broadcasted to the south and southeast of the UK at the time, at 5:10 p.m., the audio was replaced by a distorted voice with a 6-minute-long message. And I'm going to play you some of this, which I found on YouTube. Now, according to some sources, there's no recording that's still around of this broadcast, but then there's multiple YouTube videos by multiple uploaders which have apparently the message, and the message is based on a transcription which was definitely legitimately aired on TV. So either way, I don't know if this is a recreation of the real thing. This is what it must have kind of sounded like.
These include stopping the execution of all captured prisoners of war, allowing the road to take on negotiation, being arrested. In Australia, Mr. Kerry Packer's cricketers are still pleased by this for his high court decision, which didn't ban on them playing in test matches.
This is the voice of Omar, representative of the Ashtar Galactic Command, speaking to you. For many years, you have seen us as knights in the stars. We speak to you now to say this thing as we have done to your brothers and sisters all over this, your planet Earth.
Now, this whole thing is quite the paragraph already, and of course the whole message is 6 minutes long, so I'm just gonna list some of the most interesting quotes in there. So one, all of your weapons of evil must be removed, which I'm assuming refers to nuclear weapons, maybe, potentially. Number two, you have but a short time to learn to live together in peace and goodwill. Small groups all over the planet are learning this and exist to pass on the light of the dawning new age to you all. And number three, be aware that there are also many false prophets and guides at present operating on your world. They will suck your energy from you, the energy you call money, and will put it to evil ends and give you worthless dross in return. Now, about the way they achieved this hijacking, according to a Southern Television spokesman, and I quote, a hoaxer jammed our transmitter in the wilds of North Hampshire by taking another transmitter very close to it. In the following days, this had obviously caused a lot of people to be afraid, and of course people in the 70s didn't really know about the possibility of a hacking, so as you can imagine, a lot of people would initially have believed in the broadcast. Now this puts me in kind of an interesting position as a journalist here, because when I research this stuff, of course all the articles will be things like, 10 times aliens contacted us because they know that people love this stuff and a lot of people will buy into this stuff because they think it's exciting or whatever. And that then gives me the choice of either being completely realistic about this and telling you some guy was bored on an afternoon and decided to create a hoax, which, as the internet has proven, lots of people are like that apparently. Or I will tell you that yes, aliens did indeed hijack this random, easily attackable British TV station, which would be a much more exciting story. But I've thought about this, and I've decided that the way I want to present this to you is I give you the facts as they are, according to legitimate news articles that cover these kinds of events, and then I tell you what I personally believe, which you can take as a suggestion, but you can also fight me on, since it's just my subjective opinion. So, about this whole case, what seems the most likely to me is that someone affiliated with a group that was sort of hippie or new age oriented had this idea that by making up the story of an alien transmission, they could sort of spread their political beliefs. And I mean, they weren't subtle about it at all. It's clearly like anti-materialistic, with a part where they talk about the evil money and stuff. It's anti-nuclear weapons, and when they talk about small groups all over the planet that are learning about peace and goodwill, you know who they're referring to. Like, it's obviously some new age or hippie groups. Interestingly enough, this is also a cold case, and no one's ever come forward about this, so all bets are open. But to me, the name Vrillon alone sounds very sci-fi. But I want to know what you think. If you have any opinions, comments, or insight even on any of these cases, don't hesitate to send me an email to the address riversidehotel20@gmail.com. This radio station here has never been hijacked, by the way, and I hope it didn't just inspire anyone to. I feel like if you really must hijack a radio station, then there's bigger ones than CJSF. So go hijack those if you really like, but I'm not endorsing anyone to hijack anything, of course. Okay, I should just stop talking about hijacks. Thank you for listening to this segment of the yet unnamed mystery show, and I'm gonna send you back to the lobby here at the enigmatic Riverside Hotel. Yeah, so that about does it for this first episode of Good Times at the Enigmatic Riverside Hotel, which, I know, it's quite the title. I myself have to get used to saying that all the time. But yeah, I had a lot of fun doing this. I had a lot of fun with these specific segments, especially the mystery thing, which I want to do more of that kind of stuff. And I also feel like there's enough, like, urban or internet mysteries kind of that I could focus about in future episodes. The next show on this station will be SFU Issues and Ideas. And yeah, I hope with the mystery thing that, like, me playing the actual hijackings didn't, like, get anyone the wrong idea that, like, the station they're listening to right now was being hijacked. If that's what you're thinking, then don't worry, we're fine. Yeah, next up will be SFU Issues and Ideas, and you will hear from me again next Tuesday at 4 p.m.
Is that a normal part of your segment?
That's the way I've always sung. This is my song.
Are there subliminal duets?
Absolutely not.
The Metal Meltdown, a show that brings you melody-driven heavy metal from around the world. Melting your ears every Monday night from 8 to 10 p.m. right here on CJSF 90.1 FM.